News Radio WJPF, the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League, Brad Coles, on the other end of the line this morning. Brad, how are you?
I'm well. Good morning. How are you today, Tom?
Very good. And I, you know, a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about over the course of the week is going to be on our agenda today because we've got a lot of things that involve money, police, municipalities, and counties. So I hardly know where to start. So we'll start with the big thing. How's that?
Sounds good.
Have you digested the budget, taken a look at all the funding items, and what were your takeaways this year for your municipalities in the state of Illinois?
You know, the state budget this year was not too different from last year, other than it was built around borrowing about $5 billion from the federal government on the revenue side. On the expense side, meaning what the state was spending, there was a little bit of support for local governments. We've talked for years about the local government distributive fund, which is the local share of state income tax, and that's been tapped into the last several years with some modest reductions that the state kept a little bit more than they were supposed to. This year we were able to get that eliminated, so cities, villages, and towns all across the state are going to be able to see just a little bit more in their revenue formula. However, revenues are down, so ultimately they'll probably see the same or less money overall. But the budget generally was okay for local governments. There weren't any additional unfunded mandates that are going to be piling on like we've seen in the past. And as I said, a little bit of relief from some of the cuts in the past too.
You know, I sometimes whenever I'm doing interviews, somebody says something to me and I can't shake it. And this week it was Guy Alonji, DuQuoin mayor, when he was talking about preparing his departments for as much as a 30% cut. This is something you've heard in more than one community where they've heard the same story at Williamson County. And you and I both know that when you look at a budget, very often 75% of that is labor. When you look at a 30% cut across the board for departments, you start to say, who's going to go and what are we going to lose? And that is a decision no one wants to make because we're already living on the margins.
Right. Personnel is the only thing that's really left in a lot of communities because of the cuts that have happened over the last several years. As you said, anywhere from 2/3 to 3/4 of a budget involves the human resource side of the operation, so there's not a lot of room to begin with in discretionary spending. We've projected anywhere from 15 to 30, 35% reduction in revenue across various lines in communities like DuQuoin or Marion or Carbondale or Heron or any of the others around Southern Illinois, Benton. You know, they're going to see an impact because they have local sales taxes that they're going to be missing out on also. It's hard for us to project those because those are based on local activity and the rates vary. But between the state revenues that are going to be down and local revenues that are going to be down, communities are going to be hard-pressed to fund their operations at their current level. Now, that point that brings up next, which I was asked about earlier this week by others, is what does that mean for property taxes?
Yeah.
And the timing of that is critical because right now we're coming out of this COVID closure, and so some things are starting to reopen, and so the economy will begin to percolate. However, in the next 6 months, when most communities are planning for their next fiscal year's property tax levy, they're going to have to be looking at what cuts have we made, what cuts do we need to make, where do we need to raise more revenue, and property tax is going to be a place where they're going to have to look.
But Brad, the last time I was talking to a mayor of a small town, it was a confidential phone call at the time, but he was very blatant, very straightforward, and he said, look, the property taxes, that's for pensions. I've got to have that for the pensions. You know, I can't have everything else is going to go for running operations, but I can't give up property taxes to go for operations when I've got to have it to keep our pensions funded. And if we don't fund them, then they stop our tax revenue, and I cannot risk that.
Well, and this is why I enjoy talking to you so much, because that's exactly where I was headed. The problem with the property tax is twofold. One is not a problem. One is the property tax extension limitations, which is tax cap. So, you know, they can't just be raised ridiculously without the public's approval. However, that is a restriction on what they can do. The other is that all of that money in most communities goes to pay for pensions. So when we talk about personnel being the largest piece of a city's budget, local sales tax is down, state shared revenue is likely to be down. The only other source of revenue is property tax, and those are fully committed to funding pensions or are capped. This is the answer to your question. What are these communities going to do? They're in a tough spot.
Somebody right now is yelling at the radio, when are we going to run out of other people's money?
Well, I think that was a long time ago.
Yeah. I think that's right ahead. You know, and there's a lot of evidence to back that up, actually. We could go over and take a look at that. Now, here's another thing. I was talking to another mayor of a small town, and he says to me, look, We've gone out and we've made such a point of essential workers and who essential workers are. And I'm making people go to work, right, because they're keeping the water rolling, water being drained from the ditches, the mowing is getting done, and there are operations that have to go on in the town. And here I am now thinking I've got to make a 30% cut across the board for people who we deemed essential. And he says, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to make every attempt in my municipality to give people who are defined as essential employees raises. If they're essential, it should be reflected in the city's budget.
Well, it's hard to argue that theory, that mentality, and I think it's a good approach.
I do, too. In fact, that he even said that when everybody else is talking the other way. I mean, again, he says, I'm going to find a way to make this happen for our central. Now, he's living in a smaller community. It's a smaller town. He doesn't have, you know, a ton of employees. It's a more attainable goal, and they've been inherently conservative in the past. I'm kind of curious. When we talked about this, the municipalities, the counties, they're looking to the state for money. They're looking to Washington, D.C., which funnels that money through Springfield. We have become very dependent on other people during this COVID-19 challenge, and they're looking for help with people that are already in debt, as you alluded to a moment ago.
Yeah, the state's broke, federal government's broke. You know, I think I've joked on your show before when people say this isn't tax dollars, it's federal money.
Yeah.
You know, and I've said before there's only one person that can pay the bill for these things, and that's the taxpayer. But the reality is that local governments and communities of all sizes across the country were on the receiving end of the mandatory restrictions that shut down the economies locally, statewide, and nationally, and they don't have a way out. They don't have a shovel to dig their way out. They've got put in a hole, and that's the role of the state and national government in that circumstance, is to assist on these larger issues, like a natural disaster or otherwise, in this case, a public health disaster. So I think it makes sense to look to the state and the national government for resources and assistance. The problem is this state and this national government aren't in a great financial condition to begin with.
$26 trillion in debt. We achieved that 1 week ago from last Tuesday. It's interesting because when I was speaking with Senator Andy Menar about that $5 billion in borrowing and whether that means the budget isn't balanced, he said simply, well, where we're getting the money, it's all revenue, in alluding to what you just talked about, the taxpayer. It's all taxpayer revenue, so it's not really borrowing because that's how we finance everything else.
Yeah. So, you know, it's all a matter of perspective, I guess, on, you know, where the money comes from and who pays for it. That borrowing, you know, has to be paid back is an issue.
Yeah.
Now, there's some hope that the federal government will come along with funds in a future relief package that will assist states and local governments with unrestricted resources so they can pay back these loans and other things. But, you know, that's yet to happen. And frankly, the longer it takes, the less likely it is to happen. We have been working on this. I've been working on this from the Illinois Municipal League's perspective and also with our partners at the National League of Cities since April and then May. And now we're into June. July is going to come. August, they're going to be on break. September, who knows? And by the time we see it, it'll be election in November, and it may never happen. So the state did what it had to do. local governments are doing what they have to do. They're not borrowing necessarily, but we don't know what's going to come down the road in the future.
Yeah. A lot of them, you know, because of this pressure and seeing it happen, saying, you know, well, I alluded to Guy Alonji. He is sticking with his plan that they're going to be missing about $500,000 in tax revenues by the time this is done. He's planning accordingly. But that the background of that story is that all these municipal, the mayors and the city councilmen and the county executives, they want to see things return to business because, you know, they've got to get their economies rolling again. You can't keep going about this. This is a statewide phenomenon where you see municipalities, mayors railing about reopening and then adding insult to injury, canceling events that are substantial cash revenue generators like the ATA or the DuQuoin State Fair, saying, look, it's one thing we shut down our economy. Now we're shutting down these special events that are time to go. It adds insult to injury, and many people feel it's kind of punitive in nature.
Well, and I heard your remarks earlier and reading the information from Congressman Boss's office, and, you know, whether it's the World Trap Shooting or the DuQuoin State Fair or any of the, you know, Heron Festa, any of the major events that have not been able to be held or are going to be canceled going forward, there's a couple of different things to this. Obviously, the financial impact, both for the businesses that participate in those because they're a direct vendor or something, and then everything else that is supported because of the overflow, you know, the hotels and restaurants and just the different activities that are always around those big events in a community. That's one thing, and that's been devastating, and that's a real problem. There's also, as you indicated, that I can't quote what you said, but, you know, people are the most unhappy they've ever been. There is a cost to this on the social welfare side about people's well-being, their mental health, their social interactions are greatly reduced, and people are walking around afraid. You know, if you don't have a mask, you're getting, you know, a face covering on, you're getting the eye from some people. And
yeah.
And so there's a secondary cost to this, which is going to have a financial cost as well. So it's just something that we haven't figured out how we're going to come out of it. We didn't really figure out how we got into it. It just kind of happened. And we need to brace ourselves for the long-term impact, because even when things open up, and phase four of the governor's plan is projected to open things up next Friday, that's not going to solve all the problems. There's going to be a long tail to this.
Let's talk about that, because there's a second and third order of effect, and people are starting to get a sense of that too. And I've talked to more and more city leaders saying, if we lose this business and that business and that business and JCPenney from the mall and then that business and that business, and they're not here 2 and 3 and 4 years from now, that revenue that they provided for the community is gone. And how are we going to replace it in a time when brick and mortar is back on its heels? And people are starting to get a sense of what they've done and the long-range ramifications of those decisions.
They are serious issues that will have dire consequences. You talk about, and we've talked about downtowns, of course, have seen their up and down as far as the viability in various communities around the state. But as these businesses close because of this, and then there are more vacant properties, and then, you know, are people moving away? There's been a brain drain around Southern Illinois for the last 50 years of people moving to other places for opportunities because they didn't exist in the region. These are the issues that mayors are facing and city council members, you know, because they're seeing their communities, which were doing okay, but, you know, are definitely facing a tough situation now. They don't know what it's going to look like in 10 years or 20 years.
Right.
And in depressed areas economically, you know, how much worse can things get in Cairo, and how much more can they handle? They've had so many problems over the last 5 decades. This one may be the last one because there's just nothing left. And that's a real problem for local elected officials. They're trying to figure out how they can overcome it. The great thing about it as you well know, and your listeners know, because they're the reason for it, there is such a terrific spirit in Southern Illinois and a resiliency, but there's only so much people can take. And if the economy isn't there and the potential isn't there for the next generation or even this generation, then long-term is going to be hard to handle.
Yeah, every time I have Mark Keene on from the Four County Highway Coalition, I can hear listeners whispering at the radio, yeah, four-lane highway so people can get out faster. I mean, you know, I literally hear that in my head. Hey, here's a message just come in. It says, disturbing to see that local governments adopting the same tax and spend mentality as the state. People are already hurting, and they just keep piling on. I know that was a conversation we had last night at my house concerning our property taxes and how much we had in escrow to be able to pay for that. Probably one of the most important bits of the conversation we're going to have today is municipalities are looking to organizations like yourself, county and city, on what's going to happen when it comes to policing. And we're not necessarily talking about defunding the police. That is, you know, hyperbole to, I think, a certain extent, although worthy of notice. But in a practical sense, they're looking for instruction, where to go. I mean, what's next? And I would imagine your phone has been lighting up in that respect.
Oh, absolutely. And I was at the press conference that the mayor of Chicago had last week, where she announced that she's supporting the concept of licensing police officers in the wake of issues that large city has had. We've been getting calls from community leaders all over the state asking, you know, what steps can be taken to reassure people and to reassure the employees, the police officers, the women and men of these departments. One of the things we've done, the Illinois Municipal League affirmed its support of a set of 10 principles that actually were adopted 2 years ago between the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police and the Illinois NAACP State Conference that set forth a number of principles regarding the relationship between law enforcement and the communities and the people that they serve and represent. Key among those are the points of dignity and respect and rejecting discrimination, building and rebuilding trust between law enforcement officials and the public, endorsing the concept of community policing, which has been around for a long time, that helps develop a strong relationship between and among and within communities, and also encouraging community leaders to understand that there is a mutual responsibility that's required. It's not a one-way street. It is a two-way street. If you want to accept the advantages, you have to fulfill the obligations, and that means there needs to be better understanding and knowledge on both sides of policing, and of course an attention to diversity and the bigger issue, how the public is interacted with, how engagement is made between law enforcement and the public when there is a criminal act that's been alleged, and how those situations can be de-escalated, whether that's through training or this mutual respect that I just mentioned, but the de-escalation that will help reduce the number and the likelihood of some of these extreme situations, which we all know about and we have seen repeatedly and have most recently caused this new dialogue.
I've been in the back seat. I've been in the front seat. I've been running from the cops. I've literally kind of covered all the bases. And out of all those events, the one that was the most eye-opening, well, when they caught me, they're going, like, you don't know, you think you, we don't know who you are? Why would you run? Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought, and why'd I run? Because I thought I could get away. Oh, well, come over here. We've got something for you. Right? But on the other hand, I've never had anything more enlightening in my life than spending a day with a Carbondale police officer, a Memorial Day weekend with an Illinois State Police trooper on 57. I think that anybody who is telling the police what they should and shouldn't do, spend a day in the car with the cops and understand why they have a bulletproof vest on. I think that is one of the most eye-opening events I've ever had. I've gone with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Crab Orchard. They are licensed, sworn-in deputies of Williamson County. And I can tell you that every time I learned something, and it left me uneasy.
Yeah, there's a reason for police. And, you know, if we ever could go back to the day, whenever that was, that there wasn't criminal activity and there is no need for police, then that would be a great situation. We're not there. No place is there. And so it is a central part of maintaining societal norms. However, the focus has to be on just that, maintaining societal norms, making in a community or a state or just any environment safe and comfortable for people to either do business or live or play or learn. It's these additional extreme circumstances where we've gone beyond that. That's where I go back to this point about a mutual understanding and responsibility. I mean, it takes all sides to have a positive relationship with the police. And I said this, too, the other day, and I'm probably going to take up more time than you've got for me, Tom, but the point of all this is if you as a resident have a positive relationship with the only police officer in your town, that's great. And then you have a positive opinion about that police department. But if you are in a larger city and you have a positive relationship with a police officer in that community, then you should be able to have a positive opinion about the entire police department. And that's what we've got to get to. We have to get to where there's relationships and there's trust on both sides. The difficult job can be done by our law enforcement officials. The community understands what their role is. There are a lot of things to overcome, which may be either years, decades, or centuries of attitude or actions to overcome and address. And that's what we're trying to promote. That's what we want to engage. That's what local officials and mayors are trying to understand in their communities. Every community is different. One size doesn't fit all. But boy, this is an issue that every community is going to face. And out of it, hopefully, will come better, stronger communities.
Well, if there's some way I can help our guests that you would suggest on this subject, I'm ready to help, Brad.
Well, I appreciate that. And you've got, you know, great leaders down there. You know, Benny Vick does a terrific job in Williamson County, and I could name all the other police chiefs and sheriffs and everybody. But you've got local people that they just need to get out in front of it. They work with their community, they work with their officers, and they build that mutual trust and respect, and we see where it goes.